your scenario, Mel, what you just did, and Dick, what you had just talked about in your scenario with the resistor and the capacitor and the inductor, that's what we need, and it's not there. It's just simply not there. So you have to spend a lot more time researching, and I'm doing exactly what you do. I go on to Google, I look up impedance, I get the formulas, but it's so disparate, the information, you just lose interest. If there's one textbook you can go to, and it's going to be a high school level textbook, then that's what we all need. At least that's what I need. Dick?
Hey, you're illuminating, Alan, a serious problem. The way we teach electronics, I am convinced, Mel is convinced, can definitely be done better. Man is a very visual animal. You gotta give him visuals. A right triangle helps a lot. Bringing the physical components to the classroom and saying, this is what an inductor looks like, and these are the five different forms it can take. This is what a capacitor looks like. This is the four different forms it can take, and so on. That would help. And unfortunately, many of the people teaching the course are teaching it the way it was taught to them. That doesn't make it right. Just because it's the canonical form, just because it's the form that was approved by whoever set up the syllabus for that particular school, that alone is not enough. And here's what the bottom line is. Because of the way that we teach it, because we teach it in a way that is not user-friendly, the bottom line is that if you want a real radio engineer, a guy who understands wireless equipment and electronics that works at radio frequencies, you usually don't get that as a guy out of school. It takes, on the average, 10 years of apprenticeship, coming out of a good school, going into a good company, doing that work, and you put that guy under the wing of somebody who really knows the stuff, and in 10 years you've got one. When it comes to antenna engineering, I think it takes even more than 10 years. It's closer to 20 years of apprenticeship in order to really become a good antenna engineer. It doesn't have to be that way. When the guy has been through that apprenticeship, and he's learned all these tricks, and he's learned all the things that are important and not important, and of all the formulas you've been given, and all of the crazy concepts you've been given, in the real world, some of the very innocent-sounding ones that don't sound like they're important are extremely important, and some of the ones that are highly emphasized in the school, in the real world, are the secondary and tertiary effects that can almost be ignored. Let me drop. So if you manage to survive that 20 years of apprenticeship and you become an antenna engineer, or you survive the 10 years of apprenticeship and you become a wireless radio engineer, and you suddenly start saying to yourself, hey, this stuff isn't that bad. Why the hell didn't they teach it to me that way in the beginning? And the answer primarily is that the people who are in the college doing the teaching, a high percentage of them have never worked in industry. So they're acclimating you for an industry that they did not acclimate themselves for. And the person who's in the industry, enjoying it, and getting a pretty good salary, for the most part, he doesn't want to take the cut in salary to go back to school. In order for him to teach the school, he's got to have all of those education courses, a doctorate degree, and whatever. It's a lot of rigmarole, not very much job security, an awful lot of decrease in salary. So the people in the industry who know it don't get a chance for the most part to teach it, and the people who teach it have never been in the industry. So you're being acclimated for an industry by people that did not acclimate themselves. I know it can be done better. I'm not quite sure what the solution is. If you were the President of the United States, what would you do to fix this one, Alan? Hey, go ahead, Mel. And then pass it over to Alan.
Okay, a few years ago, I wanted to update my education, so I went back literally to school, as they say, to NYU, and I spent 18 months to update, because, you know, we graduated a lot of years ago, and I said, well, I want to fill in the blanks, as they say, And on the final exam, I solved problems in electrical engineering by what I know, as Dick says, from experience. I was called into the by the professor who was head of electrical engineering in that college, and he said, I wanted to meet you because you did things I've never seen before. I never even thought of ways these ways before, because I said, this is field experience. He says, because everybody, you know, normally solves the problems by how it's laid out in a book. I solved the problems by, like you say, our field experience. And he was flabbergasted to see how I came up. Never had a concept of a lot of these ways of solving problems that, you know, that we have picked up over the years. That's what I say, like you say. And that's what should be taught. It has to be taught by an experienced person. And very hard that you're going to find somebody like that is willing to go and, you know, and teach at a college level today. Over.
Yeah, stand by a minute. I heard someone else from the outside world trying to sign in. Who was that? Give us your call letters right now, sir. I heard somebody signing in, but maybe he didn't come back. You got it, Alan. KC2RFN, KC2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN. Yeah, Mel, I understand your experience. You, over years of being in the real world, built an intuitive feel for your subject, and then you having mastered it, were able to approach it several different ways. Whereas the academic professor can only really understand it one particular way. And once you showed there was another way and he worked it out, he said, wow, this guy's a genius. And, I mean, that's far from it. It's the same thing in medicine. I what I do, I could go into a lecture hall and lecture on it, and the staff professor, they will have no idea what I'm doing. In fact, a lot of the techniques I use are just honed over 18 years of practice. And they'll just never get it because they're not working on people every single day. They're just teaching in classrooms. So, Dick, you're dead on right there. There's going to be an endless disconnect. But there is an answer. And the answer I found was in the laboratory. The way they should be teaching these courses is to sit you in the lab the first day, not in a lecture hall where you're just getting the raw information. You have to sit down and start doing it. Let me drop. You're never going to learn how to play tennis sitting in a lecture hall, listening about how tennis should be played by the numbers. You have to actually do it and get engaged. And then from there, you start building up a conceptual basis, an academic basis for what you just saw. And I think that would not only be a lot more informative and educational, but it's more entertaining. It's more interesting this way because now you're actually seeing the magic. I mean, let's face it, the big draw to ham radio, and especially to the people who come onto the TechNet, is this is modern-day magic. That's really what it is. And we all want to have a better, deeper understanding of how it works because we know it's not really magic. But we know we can get our minds wrapped around it. We can get our hands on it. We just need a little encouragement, a little fellowship, and a little bit of direction. And the best way to do it is hands-on. And most of the people who are on the TechNet are hands-on people, or at least strive to be. So the answer to me, if you made me education czar, would be to just minimize the lecture hall and increase the laboratory. And I did notice, let me drop.
You know, I love radio. I grew up with radio. It's like the early 60s, and worked in radio. Plus, I worked at that station when it was classic country.
What is that?
Just go right ahead, Alan.
Yeah, that just maybe lose my train of thought. But the bottom line is, I think that the answer is to is like Mel had said. He was out in the field. He was in the real world lab. And then when he brought that into academia, he blew their mind. And that's how I would do it if you made me education czar. I would get people familiar with the components, with the oscilloscopes. They would sleep with them. That would be their textbook, not just the textbook. And then I would build each concept up from one level to the next to the next. And by the time you're done with that course, you will have really gained an intuitive feel for what you're doing. It's like playing a musical instrument. You're never going to learn it by sitting in a lecture hall. You have to sit there and practice. And that's how I would do it, Dick, for what it's worth. KC2RFM.
Thank goodness that professor that Mel came before, using his field experience techniques, which gave the right answer in a much simpler manner. Thank goodness that professor was objective enough to recognize a better technique when he saw it. There's a 50-50 chance Mel could have run into a professor saying, this is not the canonical form. And yeah, you got the right answer, but you were lucky. You didn't do it by the way that we teach you. And therefore, I'm going to take credits off on this exam because you didn't do it the right way. Thank goodness he didn't run into one of those. Now, one of the things that Wesley brought to our attention, N2XJN, well, about a month ago, is the so-called series of lectures from MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, on electrical engineering. It's a series of, I think it's called Series 18 Lectures, and I believe there's a total of 30 of them. And they pretty much do exactly what you're saying, Alan, because let me drop. What's good about these lectures is that, yeah, it's a lecture hall with about 150 students, and they're in bleachers, if you know what I mean. But across the front of the hall is an extremely good, I'm going to call it blackboard, but it's a very elaborate kind of blackboard, and laboratory benches are between the professor, the blackboard, and the students. On those laboratory benches are a sink, a Bunsen burner, a light bulb circuit. In other words, he's got real hardware there, and he stands behind this laboratory bench, and he puts an inductor in series with a capacitor and lights the light bulb and slides the inductive slug inside of the inductor, changing the inductance and making it go in and out of resonance, and you see the total current increase on the meter, and you see the light bulb, a great big 150-watt light bulb lighting. He's running a 60-cycle circuit. And that's just one of these experiments. And the blackboard itself is where he's got these little sections of blackboard where he can slide them vertically. And you don't have the Don problem I've had with some of my professors of where they're writing with one hand and erasing with the other. And this guy is, writing on one of these sections of a blackboard, sliding it vertical in order to write the next section. So his previous writings are all there in front of you. He's got a whole lot of blackboards across the whole horizontal extent of this laboratory. It's a kind of laboratory / lecture room where real hardware is there, and he's showing you the real stuff working. That's the right way to do it. MIT has got a little bit closer to the way of doing it. That's not the way it was done in my school. At my school, you had the pure lecture-type hall. Let me drop. The way it was done in my school is you have a pure lecture hall, and you go to these multiple lectures for what seems like an awful period of time. Eventually, you get a little bit of lab work, and the lab work was nowhere near as well done and the experiment sort of related to what you did, but the lab work was almost de-emphasized, and it was the lab course was considered the one credit course, and the lecture hall was the four credit course, so to speak. So they de-emphasized the laboratory work, and that's the real world. The laboratory is the real world, and that's got to be emphasized more, because when a person goes through his apprenticeship, he's really learning the laboratory for the first time. There's an amazing number of students that come out of school without the ability to operate a soldering iron. And that's a very basic skill that you really need to have in industry. With rare exception, you got to be able to solder those components together, because you got to build a working circuit. You got to build an engineering prototype, a proof of concept, a circuit, before you get a chance to manufacture something. You may have done a beautiful research job that this is the best component, this is the best way to hook them up. But how do we know we've got a viable circuit before you build a breadboard? K2LIW listening. Anybody got any further questions or comments on this so far?
Patrick, before I lost my train of thought, that's what I was going to say. Is our laboratories were not conducted by our professors. They never were. They were conducted by grad students. And, of course, that was almost... It was almost completely disconnected from the lectures themselves, and the laboratories were awful to the point of almost useless. So that just supports the point you made, and agree that's the way to go, is to bring the lab into the lecture hall. No question about it. I wonder if MIT puts out so many smart people.
Three days is copy, man. I've got a minute. That's 3 to 5 now.
Reading on the South Shore of Long Island.
No reading in Huntington.
Nothing in Brooklyn.
I heard him announce the Marconi net.
Yeah, part of the problem, as I see it, Alan, is that many of a professor who teaches it has lived in academia. He's never gone into the real world, so he's disconnected from it. And the laboratory portion of the course is beneath his station. He doesn't go to that lab. He's not involved in it. I had one professor that appeared in the laboratory one time. And like you said, it's usually taught by grad students or the guy who's in charge of keeping the equipment in working order in the laboratory. And he tells you you're supposed to follow experiment number 14 today, and here's the paperwork on it. And so, yes, there's an awful big disconnect. The laboratory could be where the enthusiasm is brought up, is built up. Thank goodness there was one enthusiastic professor at my particular school who formed a sort of a microwave club, I think he called it that. And they were assembling equipment at 1296 megacycles with a ham radio license, and they were going to do some moonbounds. And they were using the laboratory equipment and going way beyond the laboratory course. But that's unusual. And so they don't realize that man's a visual animal, a touchy-feely animal. You show them the real hardware. You show them the way it works. You let them feel it, feel the heat with their hand as the current flowing through the inductor has some IR voltage drop and creating some heat. I mean, all of a sudden, it all starts coming back together and the laws of physics start making some sense. You can give a guy a set of equations and tell him to memorize that in order to pass the test. And even though you've gone through the derivation, it's still very abstract knowledge, abstruse and abstract, and it's hard to retain. They don't recognize the fact that...
US2N.
You want to make a comment, Paul?
Yeah, Jack, I was wondering, is the problem that everybody's having, like with Mel's diagram and all, is the problem that people can't remember or understand which is coming first, what's lagging, and
leading in regard to an inductor and a capacitor? Is that the problem? Because if it is, I've read a good explanation of how to separate that to remember, like forever, which one comes first, which one comes second.
Eli the Iceman.
Sounds like you've got a memory scheme. Tell us your memory scheme, Paul.
Yes, Eli the Iceman is excellent, but a more of a practical answer to it, an understanding of which ones, you know, why one is one way and why the other one, why one is one way and why the other one is the other way.
Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, okay. So if that's the problem, then when you have it, you have the coil and you have the capacitor, and instead of going through, thinking about mathematics, you think of coil as you apply a voltage to it, put any kind of a voltage to it, the coil has it's very hard to start a magnetic field. But once the magnetic field starts to go, it's very easy for it to expand, and it's much, much easier to create a magnetic field once it gets going. So it's very hard in the beginning. So that's why the voltage is higher for a coil. And as it gets bigger, it's easier for it to expand, so there's more current that is able to flow into it once it gets bigger. So it's kind of like a balloon. If you take a balloon and you're going to blow it up, it's very, very hard to blow it up in the beginning. But as it gets bigger, the surface gets bigger, and it's much easier for the for that person to blow into that balloon, and it's easier for it to expand. Therefore, the voltage is high in the beginning, and then as time goes on, the voltage can come down, and the amperage will take off because it's easier to expand that coil. Let me drop it.
Let me say something about that.
Let me finish, Mel, otherwise it's not going to make sense. Okay, now with a capacitor, it's like a gigantic tank. A tank doesn't expand. But if you pour air into it, pump air into it, in the beginning, man, you can pour air into that like there's no tomorrow, and the tank will fill up very quickly. So it's kind of like putting the electrons into it. Now there's a lot of electrons inside the capacitor, and when you get more and more, they tend to fight each other, and including the ones that are coming in. So that creates a problem as time goes on. But in the beginning, boy, it really poured in there. So you have a high current going into the capacitor. And then as time goes on, it's harder to push them in, and then the voltage goes higher. So therefore, with the coil, the voltage is higher in the beginning, or it leads the amperage. It leads the current. And with the capacitor, you have the reverse effect. You have a high amperage in the beginning, and then you have then the voltage will follow. And yeah, that's where you get the Eli, nobody ever heard that. That would be ELI, voltage leading for L, equaling inductance, I for amperage, and ice is the other way. C is in the middle, ICE, I comes first, so you have amperage, capacitance, and then the voltage. Amperage would lead in the case of capacitor. Mel, I don't know what you were going to say, but now I'm finished. I think that's what you were getting at. I'm not sure. Then you could create this tank circuit going back and forth business. One's higher than the other one, and then the other one's lower than the other one, and it could feed back and forth together forever if there wasn't any resistance. Mel, over to you, I think. WS2S.
I'm going to pass it to Mel. After that, I'm going to ask a question to Alan with reference to his medical instruction with reference to aneurysm. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, let me explain it so everybody understands how I explained it. The equations I gave you before we just went through can be used for either capacitive or inductive reactances. But it is necessary to remember, however, that like with capacitive reactants, the voltage lags the current. Why is it? This is opposite in the inductive case. And the easiest way to remember that, if you have a piece of wire, an inductor is a piece of wire, and you add a capacitor, the voltage is going to go through the wire easier than it's going to go through the capacitor. The wire makes a better conductor. That's the way to simply remember it. Okay? Go ahead, Dick.
That does, yeah. Wesley recognized, and he'll be right up to Alan. So Eli, the Iceman, allows you to know which one leads. Mel's limage allows you to know which one it leads. In the case of medical training, where an aneurysm in a blood vessel can be an extremely dangerous thing, particularly if it's in a artery, where it starts off kind of innocent and develops into a runaway condition real fast. I wonder if the physics of what happens in an aneurysm was ever explained in a way that made sense to you during your medical training, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The answer is no to that, Dick. I became fascinated with emboli when I went into my radiology residency and how they were visualizing those and watching the fluid mechanics involved in an aneurysm. And it's really fascinating, but not described at all. There were some very neat techniques for dealing with aneurysms, other than, of course, going in and cutting them out. But, invented by non-physicians who understood these flow properties and have done some amazing things to treat aneurysms, relatively new in the past 5 years. But the actual mechanics of it were never described to us. There was never really an opportunity for it. It was just sort of something that's thrown over to the surgeon to just go in and either clip or cut out. But if you understood the mechanics exactly how Paul just put it and exactly how Mel just put it, there'd be a lot more advances in the medical field, without a doubt. But we're not given that. Maybe it's because there's so much quantity, or maybe just nobody thought to do it. But I have to say that those two, let me just drop. What Paul just said, viewing the inductor as a balloon and then viewing the capacitor as a tank, or just viewing the inductor as a wire, that's exactly the kind of inside information you need as a human being to take that abstract book learning and turn it into something that's actually useful. Because I have never looked at an inductor the way Paul just put it. And now that he put it that way, I've got a natural feel for it, because we've all blown up balloons. I know it's much harder in the beginning, and then it gets easier. And we've all filled up tanks, or at least can envision a tank that's not going to expand. That's exactly, I've never viewed an inductor or a capacitor in that fashion. That just gave me an advantage. Now, if there was a textbook or a lecture that discussed that way to view it or conceptualize it, I'd have a much better grasp of electronics today, and I would enjoy this hobby much, much more. So I hope that answers your question, Dick. So the answer is no. Nothing.
Now, as a physician, in theory, particularly if you were a cardiovascular physician, I know you're not, but if you were, you'd have to really worry about aneurysms. It's one of the many risks. With an ultrasound-like machine, one of the fairly important measurements that can be made is called AAA, AAA. It stands for abdominal aorta aneurysm. And using the ultrasound machine to look at the main aorta going through the person's abdomen and try to find out if there are any bulges in it. And if there are, it's something that's got to be addressed rather soon, because it can easily become a lethal condition in a very short period of time where there's essentially no symptom to it. Also, an LVH is another somewhat similar condition. LVH stands for left ventricular hyperplasia, I believe it is. In other words, an expansion of the left-hand side of the heart because of a kind of an arrhythmia of the left ventricle. So in either of these cases, this aneurysm-like condition, which is indicated to you whenever you're blowing up the balloons for a birthday party. Let me drop it. When you first start blowing up balloons for a birthday party, you recognize that they're very difficult to blow in the beginning and a lot easier at the end. Everyone thinks it's because they haven't stretched the rubber. That's got nothing to do with it per se. Also, if you've ever taken a fully inflated balloon and let go of it and it starts squirting around the room, you'll notice that at the end of the procedure, it starts moving faster and faster, and the air comes out of it with higher and higher velocity, even if you're holding it steady and not letting it run around the room. Some people think, well, it starts moving faster at the end because it's got less wind resistance, because it's getting smaller. That's a minor factor. You just hold it in your hand and you watch the air squirt out, and you realize the air squirts out faster at the end as it's collapsing, opposite of common sense. And by a similar technique, you'll recognize that the very small diameter, a very small angle cross-section, every very small cross-section of an English racer bicycle. You inflate that tire to 70 pounds. You take the fatter cross-sectional tire of an American bicycle, and you inflate that to 28 pounds. And they're both holding up the same weight of human being on essentially the same weight of bicycle. So the cross-sectional area of the aneurysm, the cross-sectional area of the balloon, the cross-sectional area of the tire, has a huge effect on this amount of pressure that's created in the fluid that's on the inside, whether it be air or blood, those are the fluids I'm talking about, versus the skin pressure of the rubber or the aorta itself, of the artery itself. And do you feel you've got a sense for what goes on there, or are you still kind of curious about that one, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Well, you do get a little sense and a little more education on what's happening, especially with the reference to left ventricular hypertrophy, which is what you were talking about before, which nobody should associate with an embolism. So anybody out there listening to that, they don't get worried. Lots of people have left ventricular hypertrophy. Could be just due to being overweight or untreated high blood pressure. And that actually will reduce over time as you increase those pathologies. So you do get some of the physics when you're discussing blood pressure and the whole circulatory system. You do get some very, very minor, just a touch of the mechanics, but not a heck of a lot. I had to go out on my own to read up on that, because that did fascinate me, the systems and the feedback in the system. But there is a shortfall there. There's a major, major shortfall in reading of electrocardiograms. You know, I met cardiologists and I met great family practitioners who were great at reading electrocardiograms, but for the life of them, they couldn't tell you what was actually happening at the level of the heart cells. To explain why those waveforms look the way they look. They knew what they meant, but they didn't know what was actually happening. So it was good to identify an issue right off the bat, but with an almost total ignorance of what is actually happening. A little spooky, isn't it? Quite ridiculous.
Respect here or anywhere else. Nobody wants to do
Mel recognized, but we're going to pick up Wesley first. And I've got a method of explaining why the balloon acts that way, why an aneurysm is so dangerous, and maybe I shouldn't go through it right now, but there's a way you can draw a diagram where all of a sudden it makes sense. And I haven't read that particular explanation in any good book yet. And no one asked the question why does an English bicycle need 70 pounds and an American bicycle needs 28 pounds. And how come I'm putting 1,000 pounds of mass, weight, on each individual wheel of the automobile, and I only inflate those tires to 28 pounds? And some people make the mistake of saying, well, it's got a larger area in contact with the road. No, that's not it. It's because of the cross-sectional area of the tire being larger. As an object gets larger and larger in cross-sectional area, less and less fluid pressure will cause more and more skin temperature, skin pressure, skin tension on the cross-sectional object. And there's a way of explaining that, but I won't go through that right now. Wesley, N2XJN, K2RIW.
I had two subjects to discuss. At first, I had a malfunction of my radio last week, and I couldn't really very much discuss the gravitational waves. What actually is very much interesting for me and unexplained is the magnetical component in gravitational waves, which I supported with a number of prestigious organizations in my email. But the second one is a Tesla patent from August 5th, 1890, which actually explained the electrical transformer or induction device. I was lucky enough on the other repeater to be with Glenn, who helped me out a lot. Well, I have sent you the last email, and you have also the explanation of the nature of the problem that I have had. Is this up? Okay. Problem that I have had with it is that Glenn simply suggested that with Tesla electrical transformer or induction device, there was improper drawing made by the attorney of Tesla. So, whichever subject you think you would like to discuss, I would be happy to do so. I have approached also the Department of Physics of University of Warsaw and the Faculty of Physics. I have spoke to the assistant, and he had a little bit different approach to the department, so whichever one you think would be interested.
Somebody's having a grand old time out there. Okay, let me pick up Mel first, and then we'll come back to Wesley's subject. K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I guess we've got a problem here. Now, just to finish up, I was just curious. I've been going to doctors regularly in the last few weeks, as you know, and I can't seem to get one doctor to agree with another as to one of the things you mentioned, cardiology, one of the problems with the amount of people suffering from different types of problems of that sort today is because we've discussed it, you know, this high use of tremendous amounts of salt in the American diet. And I was just wondering, have you heard what is the really the accepted by the AMA or whatever for the amount of salt that is really needed for a person to stay healthy? in our age group or in the general age group of Americans, how many milligrams of salt a day do we really should have, or is this arbitrary? And also, another part of the question, is there too much credence in the use of measurements of BMI, body mass index, Dick, over?
I think both of those are slightly controversial subjects. I did mail to Alan two references, and they've now been updated since, of both the American Medical Association and Journal of New England Journal of Medicine. Of major articles represent a significant amount of research, and my remembrance right now is that something in the vicinity of 5,000 or 7,000 milligrams per day is what an awful lot of Americans are consuming. At that time, the recommendation was 2,500 milligrams maximum per day. I've read recent, more recent articles, reasonably well documented, suggesting that a person over 50 should not exceed 1,500 milligrams per day. My research on the absolute minimum that a body needs, that a human being needs, if he's not doing a whole lot of sweating and losing a whole lot of the sodium, let me drop. My research has led me to believe that a person does not run into a hyponatremia, I think it's called, unless you get below somewhere between 200 and 500. So I think there is significant advantage of a person who is not doing a lot of sweating and not doing a lot of heavy labor to only consume 200 to 500. There's an awful lot of sodium that's naturally in our foods. Unfortunately, there's tremendous amounts of it added to our processed foods for at least two reasons. One, it drastically increases shelf life, and the other one is that the American palate seems to demand it simply because they've always had it. But I know, and not everybody, but on a significant percentage of the population, I believe it is a major aggravating factor to hypertension. And hypertension has got all kinds of nasty side effects of kidney damage, coronary damage, retina damage, probably liver damage, probably hemorrhoids. A whole lot of nasty things happen if you live with excessive high blood pressure for periods of time. The BMI, there are various physicians who put a lot of emphasis on BMI and a lot of those who do not put a lot of emphasis on it. Let's see what Alan's slant is on any of that, if you have one, Alan. KC2RFN, our physician in residence, K2RIWN TechNet.
Now, I could give you some great in-depth answers on all of that, but the truth is those are really marginal areas of medicine or the general medical areas, and I haven't practiced general medicine family practice for 18 years. I'm a cutter. You know, you need something rearranged on the guy you send it to, but I don't really get involved in body mass index and typical blood chemistries, so I haven't got much to add to that thing.
I understand. A smarter person knows what he doesn't know, and you're not sure, and I understand that. It's controversial, Mel, but I'm led to believe that 200 to 500 milligrams is all that a mature person like you and I are requires if you're not doing a lot of sweating. If you are doing a lot of sweating, then because your body does dump sodium in that way, then some further adjustments are required. But I see a lot of evidence of damage that occurred in various members of my family because this sodium sensitivity, mature onset sodium sensitivity, is what I believe quite a number of my ancestors had. And some of them died at ridiculously young ages from some of these maladies that we've already just described. And I remember seeing them pouring the salt onto their food. It was naturally in the food, particularly the processed foods, but the salt shaker was a very important implement that was on the dinner table. and boy, would they pile it on. I've watched people eat a meal and then feel they hadn't got enough salt. There's a particular friend I've got who used to literally pour salt onto the back of his hand and lick it off. Why he wanted to do it that way, I'm not sure. But my goodness, is that a fairly dangerous thing to do. And there are certain, throughout history, an awful lot of the food was preserved with salt. And so I'm sure that the fact that the life expectancy in previous centuries, let me drop, was a much smaller number. I think this is one of the aggravating factors. Now, Wesley, you've stated that you're fairly sure that there is a tight coupling between magnetic field and gravity field. And I can see how a person can come up with various theories for that. Proving it can be very difficult. If I'm sensing a gravity field, and I do something to modulate the amount of magnetic field in that area, are you suggesting that the gravity field I'm sensing would increase or decrease because I've locally changed the magnetic field? I don't know of an experiment that has proven that. And also you got a little bit of a problem when you do the experiment, because certain materials are diamagnetic, paramagnetic, and ferromagnetic. In other words, some materials will increase magnetic field, some materials will reject magnetic field. So when you apply a magnetic field to a pair of objects that you're measuring the gravity field between them, and the magnetic field creates a force, which is either in favor or aiding or abetting, or aiding or canceling the small amount of gravity field you measure, the interplay between those two makes it a rather difficult experiment. So what makes anyone really sure that the magnetic field and a gravity field are tightly coupled, they're the same thing, or whatever? Was that one of the YouTube videos? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It was not a YouTube video. I have sent you a number of links from prestigious entities, and there was a backup of information about the existence of ignored magnetic component. And this one may provide correction up to 10% of the usual electric component of and the response to the function. Now, you might say, how come did they come with the electric component? We talked about gravity. There is more in it. There is a measuring device, and it's being called SATMAGAN analyzer, SATMAGAN. Now, the operation of the SATMAGAN is based on measurement of the magnetic movement after the magnetic component is the sample and being magnetized for saturation. So we have in here unseparable magnetic field and the gravitational field. That means gravitation is the wave, like the electromagnetic field is the wave. It does have a magnetic component. I'm talking about the... Let me drop. The electromagnetic wave has the magnetic component. And at the same... the creation of SATMAGAN analyzer was for the purpose of measuring a gravitational pull with the magnetic component, and they use a magnetic techniques. So, for a quick determination of metallic iron, the most commonly used equipment is the saturation magnetic analyzer, the SATMAGAN. And SATMAGAN is the magnetic balance in which the sample is weighted in gravitational and magnetic fields. If the field is strong enough to saturate the magnetic material in the sample, then the ratio of two weights is linearly proportional to the amount of magnetic material presented in the sample. And of course, there is a number of equations whatsoever. Now, if we say that the gravitational pull does have a magnetic component, then I have a series of questions. Let me jump.
John, I think during the week you and Wesley have discovered that occasionally there's an intermittent relay in Wesley's transmitter. Is that the reason why sometimes he doesn't come back on, or he's not able to hear KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Vic. Yes, Vic, he had an intermittent problem with that relay, his transmit relay. But I think you ordered a new one. He should be back.
Yes, I am back. I can simply top it. I didn't look at my scale. So, yes, I can top it. I don't know if
your power, Wesley,
has appeared.
Up your power.
When I was asking the questions?
No, I'm saying drop your power. Go down to 50 watts.
Yes, I do have a 50 watts right now.
Okay.
Which was the point that I disappeared when I was already asking the questions?
You only disappeared after the very last drop. There was one drop, and then we didn't hear from you for the next 30 seconds.
So, my question is, if the gravitational field is the wave, then how would you characterize the magnetic component of it if you can characterize the magnetic component of the electromagnetic wave? And the second question was, if the gravitational field is the wave, then could the wave be tuned, altered, and concentrated? Of course, I have other questions. If the gravitational field is the wave, then is the magnetic component of it different from the magnetic field of the magnetic or electromagnetic wave? And if gravitational field is the wave, then what is this we're dealing with?
Okay, when it comes to magnetism and a saturated magnet and creating an electromagnetic wave, without a doubt there's a tight relationship there. But still, I'm not yet convinced that I've seen an experiment, read about an experiment, maybe I just haven't gone to the right places yet, where a relationship between magnetic field and electromagnetic wave has been related to a gravity wave. Yes, they're both waves. They're both things you don't see. They both follow an inverse square law. There's a lot of similarities. I'll give you that. But still, I don't think anyone... as of the discussions we had last week, I went and looked at all the experiments I could find on LIGO, L-I-G-O. This is that huge machine. One of them is in Alabama, one of them is in Washington State, where they're trying to measure gravity fields. And they're many, many hundreds of millions of dollars downrange, making the machine thousands of times more sensitive than it did in the beginning. And they made half-year-like measurements. And there was on February 2007, a major event in space, a gamma ray burst, which was detected on many frequencies, many portions of the spectrum. Let me drop. And they believe that the gamma ray burst is a major event of two neutron stars or a neutron star and a white dwarf or any combination of those with a black hole coalescing, coming together. A huge event occurred when it comes to gamma ray burst. And lucky for them, they were running an active experiment for months on end of making very precise measurements with the LIGO machine. The LIGO machine saw nothing. So, to my knowledge, to this date, you go to those websites you can go to on LIGO, this huge experiment, there's an American version and there's a European version, where they're looking for the gravity waves. To my knowledge, nobody has discovered the slightest bit of a gravity wave yet. So if we can't measure a gravity wave, if we can't modulate gravity, then yes, we know it's there, but we haven't measured any variation in it due to something going on in space. So it was sure it would be nice to have the LIGO machine see with some number of milliseconds or seconds of delay versus what the radio telescopes were seeing with the gamma ray burst, and measure the phase difference between the two and say that one propagates a little faster than the other. Right now, there is no evidence that that you can measure a gravity wave at all. So if we can't measure a gravity wave, we can measure the presence of gravity by having two masses and measure the attraction between the two. But we haven't measured that wave of gravity yet. So it's a real problem as I see it, and to relate it to a magnetic field, I see as a very difficult experiment. How do you separate the effects, if you know what I mean? I'm very naive on this one. We're all slowly walking through the woods on this one, as you can tell. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hey, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, I want to make sure. Okay, Cornell University. There is a text that I have in front of me. Gravitational waves brings about the relative motion of three test masses. The detailed knowledge of this motion is important conceptually and practically because the mirrors of the laser interferometric detectors of gravitational waves are essentially three test masses. There exists an analogy between the motion of three masses in the field of gravitational waves and the motion of free charges in the field and electromagnetic waves. In particular, a gravitational wave drives the masses in the plane of the wave front and also, to a smaller extent, back and forth in the direction of the wave propagation. So at least we here have a brief description of what we're dealing with. Then I'm going further, it's not long. To describe this motion, we introduce the notion of electric and magnetic components of the gravitational force. Analogy is not perfect, but it reflects some important features of the phenomenon. Using different modes, we demonstrate the presence and importance of what we call magnetic component of motion of free masses. So, Cornell University was able to establish existence of magnetic components. And it's not only them. You have a few other papers. It contributes to the variation of d distance between a pair of particles. We explicitly derive the full response function of two-arm laser interferometer to a gravitational wave of arbitrary polarization. We give a convenient description of the response function in terms of the spin-weighted spherical harmonics. We show that the previously ignored magnetic component may provide a correction of 10% or so to the usual electric component of the response function. The magnetic contribution must be taken into the account in the data analysis in
if the parameters are of the radiating system.